Born in the pandemic era, thriving in the Zoom era, it's Resonance Rewind, sharing lessons from the creatives of yesteryear for the population of today.
Captain Jean-Luc Picard, you lead the strongest ship of the Federation fleet. You speak for your people.
I have nothing to say to you. And I will resist you with my last ounce of strength.
Strength is irrelevant. Resistance is futile. We wish to improve ourselves. We will add your biological and technological distinctiveness to our own. Your culture will adapt to service ours.
My priority has been to develop some kind, any kind of defense strategy.
The truth is, hell, we are not ready.
Sir, the coordinates they have set, they are on a direct course to Sector 001, the Terran system.
Earth. What the hell do they want with you?
I thought they weren't interested in human life forms, only our technology.
In less than 24 hours, this armada is going to hit that war vessel with everything we can muster. Either they survive or we don't.
I wonder if the Emperor Honorius, watching the Visigoths coming over the Seventh Hill, truly realized that the Roman Empire was about to fall. This is just another page in history, isn't it? Will this be the end of our civilization? Turn the page.
I am Locutus of Borg. Resistance is futile. Your life, as it has been, is over. From this time forward, you will service us.
Apparently, Wolf 359 is a real location, so we understand. But thankfully, in our dimension as yet, we haven't quite gone down the line of the Borg. Best of both worlds, you could say. It's the best of Star Trek, the original series. It's the best of the Star Trek, the Next Generation. Larry Nemechek, of course, in the quintessential guide to the whole series, the Next Generation companion, Star Trek, the Next Generation, effectively regales us with a tale of 1990 being a time when the whole scenario was awash with fans really acknowledging that, yeah, maybe, just maybe, Star Trek, the Next Generation wasn't just the new kid on the block, but was a rightful inheritor to the throne. But let's talk about best of both worlds. And before we actually move to Larry Nemechek, let's find out, Ian Barnsley, Ian, your thoughts on this particular episode of Star Trek, The Next Generation.
I remember watching it the first time round, and I liked it then, and I like it just as much now. It's one of my favourite episodes. I'm glad you asked us to have a look at it, because it's one that always sticks in my mind. We are going to talk about both episodes, but obviously this one's about episode one of the two. I enjoyed the best thing for me in this was Riker. I think you're going to ask me about who I thought the best character it was, but I just think in terms of Riker, it's not so much about Picard. It's for me, it's more about Riker and whether or not he wants to be a captain or not. And of course, he's thrown into it as a captain because of what happened in the episode. It's a great episode in my book.
I gather you're not so much a fan of Commander Shelby, though. Her approach perhaps a little bit too aggressive, perhaps?
She's very like Riker when he was in the first episode, you know, quite ambitious, looking to go places. And she's quite cold and focused in that. But of course, they've all got a job to do. They've got a really serious issue going on. They have to put that to one side, don't they? And I think they do that. They work together quite well in the end. At first, it's a bit frosty, though.
Mm-hmm. Larry, this was a period in the show's history where clearly there's a bit of a sea change occurring. We're seeing the reins being gradually handled by Rick Berman, and of course Michael Piller is writing this episode and putting things together. Share with us some insights that you've obviously got in terms of how the thing progressed and so on.
Well, best of both worlds, they went from 0 to 60 in one season. They've been, you know, the first couple of seasons Gene. They'd had the famous Chaos on the Bridge, as the documentary title goes, with the writing staff. The production side of things was finding its way. The third season is really where both sides of the ball came together. They wound up with Michael Piller coming to the show late, behind the gun, and the early third season, he was really trying to catch up. But Michael Piller, to start catching up and get behind the eight ball again, instituted that fans who had no agent or had no professional writing at all could at least submit ideas, and they came up with a release form to get around the legalities of that and the liability screen. And what was insane about the first part of the season, by mid, you know, all the episodes, but by the middle of the season, the Offspring, Data's daughter, and the Way of the War, Sins of the Father on the Klingon side. There were so many great shows starting to come together. I don't know that they saw the Best of Both Worlds coming, but there was gradually, and still some less thans in that bunch, but they saw this approaching. They'd done the Borg second season, wanted to circle around back to that, but they needed a story that would work, because the bad thing about having a big bad is they can't be too big. How are they big and dramatic and that you still wind up, you know, triumphing in the end? But the scary thing was there were a lot of question marks floating around. Michael Piller didn't know if he wanted to stick with the show after 1 year because it was exhausting, and his writing staff, a lot of them were up in arms. Even some of his friends were like, you know, Ira Bear was like, Mikey, I've got to leave. I can't take this stress. And there were some questions about whether Patrick Stewart was making noises, even though he had at least a 5-year contract to leave. And all of that was adding to some uncertainty about the way the show was going down. And the amazing thing of all is Michael Piller came up with this idea without having a conclusion before they took their hiatus. So it's like, I'm going to set up this script. So maybe I won't be back. Maybe Patrick. Now, there was more of a chance of Michael not coming back than Patrick was really going to be there. But that was something in the air. But he really wrote the part one, not knowing if he would truly be there at the end to come back, or if anybody would know how to land it once they launched this, you know, one of them, I would say one of the two most famous cliffhangers in American TV history after Who Shot JR on Dallas. And this kind of revised the notion on Star Trek, much less in American television.
Yeah, I mean, certainly, I think a number of key points that you've made there. Of course, Yesterday's Enterprise was another season three episode, which you reviewed in a previous episode of Resonance Rewind. And clearly you're getting the notion that the series is finding its routine, but it's fascinating that there is that hiatus, as you say, before we come to what we'll be considering next time, of course, Best of Both Worlds Part 2. I mean, there are certain policy companies that work on that basis. I hear apocryphal tales that James Bond movies never quite know how they're going to end, and they tend to shoot it as they went along, certainly in earlier areas. But for a TV series, which normally needs to be planned out and mapped out, that's quite a bold statement.
Well, it is, but it's also, I don't want to say it's that TV was, the production was, you know, was loosier, goosier in those days. The Next Generation was not a sure thing. Remember, I mean, they were a ways down the road from the first season when people thought they'd go one and be done, and all the cast expected to be canceled by the end of the year because it was a sequel, as Rick Berman would say later, a sequel syndicated sci-fi. It had three strikes against it as far as, you know, and the third season was the gears were starting to get oiled. They were starting to have the well-oiled machine, but it was the hiatus. It was this cliffhanger that just blew the barn doors off. And that summer, you know, Patrick Stewart has a famous story, and I think he repeats it in his new book, where he's taken that summer, he's driving around LA, and a woman, a family pulls up next to him, and the woman is driving, and he's sitting at the light and kind of looks over, and he, you know, part of him is like, oh, it's fans, they're going to recognize me, but it's fine. And he kind of nods and smiles, and he notices them looking at him. Yeah. So she kind of gestures. She starts to roll down her window, and he does too, because it's a long light. And they go from smiling to looking at him and saying, "You ruined our summer," which was just a barometer, a tiny take on what was happening, you know, out in the culture, because that summer and then that cliffhanger, the part two return, and then the fourth season being the fourth series being off and running. And that's when Star Trek and The Next Generation really exploded. Mm-hmm. And every year, fourth season, fifth season, sixth season was just another, you know, another march on the ratings mountain. And it started with, and yes, yesterday's Enterprise, there at the end of Next Gen, there was, you know, they would do the polling, what was the best. And it was usually divided between yesterday's Enterprise, which was the great, you know, alternate universe time travel thing with the Enterprise C. It was always a tie between yesterday's Enterprise and the Best of Both Worlds. But clearly that was showing the upward trajectory of the series, and people were, you know, really excited. But apart from that, yes, Shelby was such a great, you always remember her line, you know, when Riker and her are having their final head to head in the turbo lift early on, and her line about "you're in my way," it's just a real, it kind of sums up the whole bit, but it's a great setup for, are they going to bang heads the whole time, or finally when the gears come together? Yeah. And I just want to add one more thing to here in the beginning, Ian. This was the episode where I'm with you on Riker and Jonathan Frakes, because not on Jonathan so much, but there were a lot of the characters that they didn't really have a handle on. Poor Geordi. They were still trying to get him right the sixth season, and give him backstory and all of that. Besides just, oh, he has bad luck with women. What a lousy thing, especially looking back now in hindsight. But I remember watching this one. My experience was, I remember watching this and realizing, oh, like Riker has finally coalesced as a character. I finally get it. They had accidentally given him command chances before, and they were just one-off moments and episodes. And this is the one where someone, Michael or somebody, said, wait a minute, there's a pattern here, you know? And so then now they're going to hit it on the head with this one. And it's all bound up with this drama about moving him out of the way. But now, do you do it in the middle of a crisis like this?
We talk favorite moments. You've alluded to one, Larry, with respect to the turbo lift scene where Elizabeth Dennehy's incarnation of Shelby says, "You're in my way, Commander." Is that your favorite moment, or are there other moments from this that you think actually that really stands out?
Well, I'm not one to have like lists and number ones and number twos, but if I just stop and think of the episode, that's the, well, and then of course the other is the one that you all remember, where the, at least the first airing in America, the screams across the country, because it was syndicated. So you got a little bit of it every night in different times, but the whole blow up ending at the end, you know, Mr. War fire, dum, 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 you know, to be continued. That whole little bit is infamous as well. The screams and howls in every market by market situation are, you know, legendary. And it's amazing. We go back to that still now, between the strikes and the streaming world and the delays, you know, you never know what's going to happen. Pandemic, a strike, and to have a cliffhanger as we've been having. And now we famously have on Strange New Worlds at the moment. People are, and the old timers will say, my God, we thought 3 months was an eternity. And now you're going to wait maybe 12 months, maybe now longer because of the strike delays, you know. But yes, that 3 months was an eternity.
Ian, your favorite moment, please.
I was just going to say, I mean, the end of it is, it's got to be a great moment. To think that we had to wait a year to work out what happened at the end, to find out what happened. Of course, now we can just watch the next episode. It seamlessly links into it. I think the one I would say, Riker, I like when Riker wants to go on the away mission. He's desperate to go and try and save Picard, but he's told he can't. He's, you know, that one person on that ship that can tell him he can't do something tells him he can't do it. That was the thing that got me.
I'd like to put in a little nod in the direction of Whoopi Goldberg and Picard, or Patrick, yes, Stewart, and the touring of the Enterprise, and obviously the allusion to Nelson. You know, Nelson toured the HMS Victory before Trafalgar. Yes, but Nelson never returned from Trafalgar, did he, says Guinan. No, but the battle was won. I mean, a wonderful foreshadowing there of possibly mortality, possibly the sort of indication that what we have here with respect to Picard is, you know, a sense that, you know, clearly, and again, the meta-narrative, the original series lasted for 79 shows. Third season, that was it. The final words, what might, you know, if only, as they went off into the system there. Here we have a scenario where, yeah, clearly a whole, you know, area is opening up, and suddenly, you know, it's overtaking in popularity. But I would say, I think the Guinan scene was quite significant. And we see another sequence with Guinan and Riker, which I think is equally significant in Best of Two Worlds Part 2. Larry, any more favorite moments?
Well, you're getting back to them, so thank you for that. Again, I think this is... I remember watching yesterday's Enterprise and thinking, well, that's it. They have finally equaled the dramatic power and even quality on a 1990 TV one-hour budget, the power and not less than, because it's television, small screen, of the movies. Like, the best of the original series they have now equaled. And I remember thinking Best of Both Worlds was in that same vein. But again, what they did for Riker's character. In fact, everybody was just, you know, in sync. And even the away mission where they go over just to scout it out. And some of the, you know, the baby Borg in the cabinet, you know, the pullout. You thought that Q-Who, when they first found the Borg, was spooky and dramatic and, you know, chilling enough. And what they're able to do. I mean, I remember being slightly aware of going, well, you know, this is TV. They can't do what they do on a movie scope and budget, but they're getting there. They're expanding, mm-hmm. and just being impressed by what a dramatic wallop this made. And then, yes. And then even you come careening down the end and you're watching the clock and you go, wait, they can't get out of this. And oh no, are they going to, and wind up with the, kind of like watching the countdown to not finishing the story and thinking, oh my God, they're going to do this.
It was directed by Cliff Bohl, of course, music by mm-hmm. Ron Jones. Again, I think the music has its cinematic routine. It's no surprise that it was actually released, I think, overseas, not necessarily theatrically, but certainly they combined it together in terms of one movie episode.
Well, and I don't want to go, the interesting, when they came out with the remastered DVDs, and they were, you know, done separately, but somewhere along the way, they edited these together. And it may have been the edit you all had, but they did edit that together. You had an option. You could either watch them separately or it was one smooth flow. And people didn't like, over Americans anyway, that experienced watching it. They want the moment. They almost want to relive the moment that the To Be Continued hit, you know, Mr. Worf fire. And they don't like it, just like, wait, it just moves along like nothing happened. And it's really funny how in hindsight people have the choice. I don't know what modern audiences that never saw it before, that didn't, you know, live the moment in real life, but I know at the time they released this, most people were saying they didn't want them edited together. They wanted the agony of the cliffhanger for a moment.
Well, we will find out with Jessica Burtis, of course, and of course, I think Jared Palmer will be sharing us their first thoughts on this whole thing. Ian, favorite character? We've already alluded to. Are you going to add any honourable mentions?
I just go back to Riker, I'm afraid. I just want to say one thing about Riker that I didn't spot the first time I saw that episode, was that the ship he was going to go to was the Melbourne, wasn't it? And the Melbourne was the one that was blown up. Well, one of them at Wolf 359. So if he had have got that job and had taken it before, he would have died. So I think that's quite an important part of that episode that isn't really alluded to very strongly, but is behind everything, actually, in that decision saved his life at the end of the day. His decision to stay with his family as opposed to going off and being a leader on his own right saved his life in the end. So I that's the thing that stuck with me at the end of that first episode. And I agree, it needs that stop in it after fire. Yeah, it absolutely needs that break.
Yeah, there's one other little story here. One of the other iconic moments of this, you know, you do get the assimilation, but we do have enough story time in part one where we see Picard taken by the Borg after he's beamed over. He's marched around. They do that very uncomfortable for 1990, you know, the drill in where they're starting to add the Borg pieces the slow way, the old fashioned way, the OG way. And then you get the iconic moment when he's, you know, right before Mr. Worf fire, when they come to that decision and it makes it not easy. But Riker knows what he has to do. Of course, the weapon winds up, spoilers, the weapon winds up failing in the first minutes of part two, and they have to go down another path. But the iconic moment that everybody remembers is Locutus in all his glory at first light with the laser, and that was completely done on the spot. They didn't exactly know they were going to play with something, and of course you can't point a laser right to a camera unless you've protected the cameraman and the eyepiece, and you've got to do some laser protections for your eyes. But that was a happy creation in the moment with Cliff Bowl and Mike Westmore and Bob Blackman and everybody involved in what the makeup and costume combination would be like. So it's one of those great moments where one of the most iconic moments of all is something that's, you know, just organic to the moment of the creators.
So I'm going to throw in Commander Shelby as my favorite character, and I do think it's a pity she hasn't kind of reemerged, although she has. She finally, after a gap, did kind of come back in another incarnation. Was it Strange? There was I think it's Picard, in fact. She might have actually.
It was Picard
emerged.
For
it was Picard. Yeah.
About that long.
So. Yeah, exactly. So she has actually had, various novels have featured her as a lead mm-hmm. character or a line within that. And certainly the New Frontiers, I think, is also connected with her from that point of view. But Larry, your favorite character?
I'm with Ian. I have to say Riker, just because of what it meant to his character. But it's a wonderful ensemble show. I mean, Data and Geordi are here, obviously. It's a great, you know, with all the talk about Gates McFadden and Crusher and her season 3 of Picard arc, that this is one of the times she gets to go on the away mission. I was also remembering that the whole reason she's on the away mission is because Gates had told Michael Piller, gosh, I wish I could go and I want to fire face her. It's like, doctor, do no harm. What's up with that? But takes me back to in Data lore in first season. I was shocked when she strides into the room and, you know, and is trying to put down lore in that one. And so on one end, it's not that radical, but it was kind of a lost. She had been, you know, was missing second season, had the character and had Gates come back third season and then building it up through that. And had just gotten a Dr. Crusher plot with Transfigurations. So the idea that she had a strong scene here in all the years of trying to build up, especially the women characters, and Jerry Taylor would do more of that later. But this is a little moment where she gets to be, you know, rough, tough and rough around the edges herself.
So let's do the scores then. Ian, for Best of Both Worlds Part 1, what's your mark out of 10?
For Part 1, 9.
Larry, I know you are a very harsh marker when it comes to this. Heaven only knows what you've actually given Spectre of the Gun in the end. I mean, it kind of vacillated between 8, 8, and I think, Ian, you were on an 8 for that. I think a 7, and then a 3 was given by one of our contributors last week. But then again, that's another line. So what are your thoughts on Best of Both Worlds Part 1?
Yeah, I missed the Spectre of the Gun, but that's definitely a show that has improved with age over time. Because of the backstory, like, oh, it was imaginary fragmentary world. That's what it was, not bad budgets. I have to say, I don't know if I'm going to judge a Next Generation episode how I don't give this a 10. Now, sadly, part two was, you know, finished the story, and we haven't talked about part two as an episode. And it's a little bit of a letdown, but by that time, nobody cared. They were just happy to see the story finished. So I would say I'm going to do it, Alex. I'm going to go ahead and say it's like if I don't give this a 10 for Next Generation, what? I mean, there's only 3 or 4 other episodes that might approach this. So I'm going to say 10.
There you go. Interesting enough.
History made today.
Yeah, I very much so. A spoiler alert, my 10 would probably be reserved for Family, which I always think is part of the trilogy within this. But that's another issue for another time. Larry, as ever, a delight. Just share with the listener in terms of how people can follow your own podcasts and work within the world of Trek.
Everything's at LarryNemechek.com. Larry Nemechek, I'm still on X, Twitter, and Instagram. YouTube is where my channel video, we do my live stream on Tuesdays Live. The Trek Files is my Roddenberry podcast. And Second Opinion is my instant reaction a review show on my channel too. So all of that, and then Portal 47 for more deep diving, and our tours in LA for anyone ever in LA, if you want to do location site touring.
And of course your book on Star Trek Next Generation is still available.
Oh, and it is out there. It's not in active print, but it's very much out there and available.
Very much.
The companion, Next Gen companion.
Absolutely. Time for a musical break. And then we'll find out what some of our other new participants make of Best of Both Worlds Part 1. Well, if you want to be precise, Wolf 359, as I said earlier, is a real star. It's also an extremely faint red dwarf, approximately 7.8 light years from Earth, and it's also the fifth nearest star to our very own sun. Anyway, that's got rid of that. We've heard from Larry Nemechek. We've also heard from Ian Barnsley. Jessica Burtis, let's turn to your good self first. You've obviously heard what Larry and Ian thought about the whole thing, but share with us, presumably the first time you've actually seen this particular episode of Star Trek The Next Generation.
Yeah, so this is the first time I've seen this episode, and we haven't watched as much of The Next Generation as we have the original series. So it was fun seeing Picard and getting some new faces as well. And just seeing how different the show looks compared to the original series. You can tell it's a little bit later. And I think that there's a lot more characters. There's a lot more happening. And this is also one of the first times I've really gotten to see the Borg and see what's going on with them and how they interact with the Enterprise crew. So I was also surprised by how much was in this episode. It was an hour and a half, I'd say, the part one. Or did I watch the combined part?
You've seen both, in which case you've obviously seen next week's as well, which is part two. Now, part one with the cliffhanger ending basically is when they're just about to open fire on the Borg cube. So we'll have to hold back some of those spoilers there. But nevertheless, how did you feel it unfurled up until the point where basically Riker is pretty much in sole command of the Enterprise?
I really liked it, and I wasn't sure what to expect going into it. I'm very fond of the original crew, and I'm used to them now. But I liked the tension, not just between the Enterprise and the Borg, but between the crew, with what was going on between Riker and Shelby, and some of the tension itself on the ship. So it was kind of interesting how they weren't just dealing with an external threat, but they were also dealing with a lot of discord going on that was internal. And I kind of liked how they were showing that bouncing back and forth, because it provided a bit more, I think, of a dynamic show than just, oh, we're all united against this common enemy. It's, well, we've actually got a lot of issues going on with ourselves. So I thought that made it so interesting. So I didn't think it was, it didn't have a lull for me. Clearly, because I ended up watching a full hour and a half, but you know, I liked it a lot.
Yeah, well, I mean, we'll be analyzing part two of course next week, but let's turn to somebody who, like yourself, Jessica, wasn't even born when this aired 33 years ago, but I'm sure he will have seen it beforehand. But Jared Palmer, what are your thoughts on Star Trek The Next Generation's first two-parter? Of course, we're just looking at part one this week. Best of Both Worlds, part one.
Well, I think this is the third time I've watched this episode. I think I remember watching it on repeats, and then I watched it on Netflix when we had it from the complete series. I think for me, this was pretty much one of the best episodes of the Borg in Star Trek for me, because I really did like how threatening they were. And I've always loved the idea that the Borg are sort of like Star Trek's sort of version of the Cybermen. And you can clearly see it by the collective of how sort of it echoes back to like communism and like the collective idea, like there's no individuality, no individual will, it's all one big collective. And I really did like the episode, and especially like the bit at the end where you see Picard just walk around the corner, and you see he's already been converted, which I think for me as a kid, it sort of blew my mind to see my hero, because I'd watched the later episodes being turned into a villain, and I didn't really know what to think about it. But growing up, it was very fun to see this, and I think to me, this is where Next Gen does become a little bit more better in terms of the episodes afterwards, but I also do think this is where the Borg start to become a real threat for Star Trek, and definitely one that would haunt Picard for the rest of the episodes, of course, into the movies and even into the new show. So, yeah, I think overall this is probably one of the biggest influences of the Star Trek going forward as well.
As we heard, there was a certain amount of discord going on behind the scenes, a certain amount of uncertainty. Jessica, if you recall, I think you were with us when we looked at the opening first ever Star Trek The Next Generation episode with the encounter at Farpoint, where we had, of course, the Ferengi in the background, but we also had the Bendy and those two gelatinous fish who or space life forms that were actually there. I mean, do you feel as though, you know, obviously, a lot has happened in the interim three seasons. This was the end of the third season. What were your favorite moments that came out of this particular episode?
I think one of them was the confrontation between Riker and Shelby in the elevator. That was just the way that she was kind of talking back to a superior, and he was kind of just letting her, but then, you know, he could tell that he was very shocked, but also not completely with how she was acting. I thought that was one of the better scenes because it was just like that bit of tension among the crew. I thought that was really good. I think also the reveal of Picard being a Borg too was really, like, when he turns to the side and you see all of the cybernetics on him. I don't know why they also gave him abs, the Borg abs. I think that was one of the funnier additions. It kind of made me laugh. I was like, took me out of the scene for a second because I was like, started laughing. But I think that those scenes were really good. And also just when Shelby was asking Riker, you know, oh, is it just as good as I hear working on the Enterprise? And he's like, oh, every bit. And then they have to deal with a whole Borg threat. Like, I think that was quite the funny looking back on it. But I also, I like the Borg ship a lot. So anytime we saw the ship, I thought it was interesting that it was a cube instead of like the normal kind of spaceships that you think of. It definitely made, like Jared was saying, that like uniformity of the Borgs seem more apparent with their ship, how it couldn't even have any abstract shape or anything. It had to just be a perfect square. Funnily enough, actually, there's a theme park that's about like 3-5 minutes away from my house. And when I was a kid growing up, they actually had a ride that was the Borg Assimilator. And it had like the spaceship in the water, and you would fly on the track, and they had voices saying, you know, resistance is futile. So I thought that was kind of cool, getting to have this connection to my own childhood with the ride and the show.
Yes, strength is irrelevant, resistance is futile. We wish to improve ourselves. We will add your biological and technological distinctiveness to our own. Your culture will adapt to service ours. I mean, ultimately, I suppose the nightmare vision of issues relating to communism versus capitalism and so on. Although, again, the loss of self that we do obviously see manifest in episode two, an extraordinary line of that. But we'll talk about episode two as the thing comes around. Jarrett seems to have actually been absorbed by the...
the Borg took him.
Much as in the first part of the program, Ian Barnsley also was lost for a wee while. So, yeah, clearly we'll have to continue on that basis. But let's start talking characters, Jessica, because, you know, again, you're just getting to know this. I mean, clearly you have Geordi LaForge, the engineer. You have the young... Will Wheaton as Wesley Crusher, who clearly it's his first ever time in which he actually gets to play at the poker table, and I mean, I must admit, I thought that was he was possibly a little bit too devastated when he realised that he hadn't called Riker's bluff. And that he actually lost the whole thing, whereas of course Shelby clearly proving that she was very much perceiving Riker as being in her way, both career-wise and otherwise. She was very keen to actually progress with that. So an interesting line from that point of view. Jared, we're just in the process of actually sharing favourite characters, but what's your favourite moment?
I would say two. I would say Picard being revealed to be a Borg, and I would say the elevator scene with Riker and Shelby. It was very interesting because even though I had watched the episodes from earlier and also later when I first watched it, I did sort of kind of understand why Shelby was like, she was trying to like get ahead in her career, and she felt that Riker was just being like stubborn and not willing to give up his role as commander and leave. And I think it was an interesting one because I don't think Will intentionally wanted that. I think he was wanting to leave eventually, and of course he does later later on in the movies. But I think for now, I think the reason why we kind of wanted to stay, because I think he kind of got used to being in the Enterprise, and I think he really liked it. And I think it was just to show that, like, it was more than just like a career for him. It was more like a family. And I really did like that moment as well, to show that Riker does still care about, like, everyone else's, like, ideas. And also, like, the way that he talked to Picard as well, as Picard really does respect him and he wants Will to move on in his career. And I did really like the interactions between those two.
It's very much a challenge that resonates, I think, in all manner of careers. And I speak as someone who never anticipated spending 31 years at a single university. But from that point of view, you know, clearly there are aspects. Riker is very capable. He's clearly he's been offered various commands of his own. But as Ian pointed out, in terms of the fictional world, had he actually taken on board his role as captaincy of the Melbourne, he would have lost his life. So in some ways, actually, staying with Enterprise actually meant that he kind of obviously kept on in this adventure of life. And I suppose also, again, as we saw in the early incarnations of Riker in the first season, he had an awful lot of Shelby-like characters, and I think that, or characteristics, in terms of wanting to look after the captain and obviously caring from that point of view. So it's an interesting tension that we see there. Of course, we haven't really spoken about the Admiral who introduces Picard to Shelby and basically says she needs to be not necessarily looked at, but actually considered and obviously viewed from that point of view. I think that was an interesting perception in terms of how the narrative was developed. Okay, favorite moments. Jessica, any honorable mentions for characters and folk that effectively you feel actually helped enhance the storyline? You can even mention, as I say, the joys of the computer voice by Majel Barrett if you want. I'd certainly give a special mention to Whoopi Goldberg as Guinan.
Oh, sorry, I think the Borg were interfering for a second. I couldn't hear you. I don't know what happened with the sound. I think for character, I think for this episode, Picard was kind of in the background a bit. I think that Riker and Shelby were really standouts in the episode because I think so much of the tension and dialogue revolved around them and their conflict and Shelby trying to prove herself and, that whole situation with, how Riker had to stay with the Enterprise. But I think that actually my favorite character is just the Borg ship. I think the cube flying through space is my favorite character. I just think it's excellent. It's just, it seems so perfect for these aliens, these cyborg aliens. So yeah, I think the cube, it was my favorite.
I mean, it certainly has become iconic and emblematic of the whole Star Trek universe and was very much at the heart of the entire second season of Picard a wee while ago with respect to that. So, you know, inevitably, it does actually carry with it a whole range of connotations. We haven't really looked at other Borg examples as yet, but I think the relentlessness that we actually see there and indeed the arguably the hopelessness of actually going up against the sequence. And, of course, the loss in many ways of Riker's father figure in Picard and arguably the Enterprise crew as well. I mean, you have here somebody who, unlike Kirk, is a more mature captain, a captain in his late 50s, early 60s, as opposed to the more dynamic, some might say virile William Shatner incarnation that we saw with respect to that as well. So intriguing from that perspective. Jared, what about yourself? I mean, I noticed you put something which you will be considering in the not too distant future, but that's of course the time travel first contact routine. But what about your favorite characters?
I would have to say for this episode, it would have to be Riker, because I think the one thing I love about this episode is how like uncomfortable he gets as the scenes go on, especially when Shelby's like talking back to him, and then later on he's having to take on John Luke's role as the captain, and he's having to take command of the Enterprise, and the bit where he says, "I'm going to leave the away team," and then he realizes, hang on, I'm the captain, I can't do that anymore, I have to stay with the ship. I think that was a really big moment for his character as well, to get used to sort of the command role. And of course we do sort of see this in season 7 when Worf goes through alternative dimensions to the version of Riker that actually stayed as captain of the Enterprise. So, yeah, I would say that for so far, it's Riker for this part. But for the next part, that will change, of course.
Well, again, interesting. So we mentioned, obviously, Admiral Hanson, played by George Murdoch earlier. There are probably four major female characters here, Jessica, that I think stood out. Obviously, Marina Sirtis, who, interestingly, there's a juxtaposition shortly after Riker's had his confrontation with Shelby. And, of course, he's met with Jean-Luc Picard, and he's actually asking her, as ship's counsellor, is he basically... not there. And of course, she has the ultimate put down. He's very seasoned, to which she responds, that's a horrible thing to say to a man. Well, as somebody who probably is now seasoned from that point of view, I think we just have to live with it. But how did you feel that women were kind of represented within the sort of piece? Because, of course, there's Gates McFadden as the let's go on away team and shoot some Borg, Dr. Beverly Crusher.
Star Trek, I think, is one of the shows that tried to do quite a lot with women in roles that were active throughout a lot of periods where women were not active in sci-fi media. And I do think I do like not having to watch multiple characters throwing themselves at William Shatner with this. I think it's refreshing.
It doesn't happen that often, Jessica. So, it has to be said. I know you keep saying that that's the case, but actually, if you look at... point by point, it's not necessarily as frequent as you may think.
I don't know. Maybe it's just the episodes we watch, because every time, I don't know.
Spectre of the Gun, for instance, as you said, that was Chekhov who actually had the love interest.
Finally, yes, it was so refreshing.
This Side of Paradise, that was Spock who had the love interest. You know, there are lots of areas.
Somebody else, but I liked Shelby in this. I thought that she was very feisty, and I don't think that they were portraying her as being like, I don't know, like an annoying, nagging character. I think that they were actually trying to show her as having her own mind and really trying to call out Riker when she felt like he had gotten too comfortable in this very illustrious role he had, and that he wasn't really respecting it quite as much as someone like her who wanted that position saw it. So I thought that they did a good job. And I think, I mean, there's always like ways to improve on shows from older times and even now, but no, I think credit should be given where credit's due. I think they did a good job.
In fact, really the only one that you've actually seen were arguably Captain Kirk did have a romantic entanglement, and that was because he was actually suffering from memory loss and amnesia, was indeed the episode where Miramani effectively fell in love with him as Kirok in the Paradise Syndrome. So you mustn't judge the entire series by that in terms of the original episode. I'm just saying. Moving on from that, any other comments, Jared, with respect to the music and the mise-en-scene, the direction, the pace of the whole thing? I mean, obviously it is 33 years old. Does it still stand up well today? Because clearly the Blu-ray release and the high definition versions have clearly sort of proven to be as popular as ever.
I would say it has, for me personally. I think it's because it's going back from when I was younger. I still remember like the visual effects of the way it looks, and I still think it holds up today pretty well. I think overall, I really did like the mise-en-scene, how they used the Borg at the start to like set them up as this big galactic threat, especially with the decimation of the planet they beamed down to. And I really did like the way that they directed it from Riker's point of view, of him like having to like still be the commanding officer, but also have that moral dilemma. Do I take this command? Do I leave the ship or not? And I think for me, I really did like, and of course, I think the ending was probably one of the best like cliffhanger endings in Star Trek I've seen. And I especially did like how it sets up the next episode. And of course, that episode, of course, sets up for the rest of sort of Next Gen's themes. And of course, it sets up Deep Space Nine. So.
Yes. Well, the Wolf 359 thing, which Jessica, you may recall, actually, we looked at when we looked at the first episode of Star Trek Deep Space Nine. This, we've kind of gone backwards, is the upcoming battle at Wolf 359, which of course led to Benjamin Sisko losing his wife and obviously taking his son Jake and becoming commander of Deep Space Nine. So it all beginning to knit together as we slowly We gradually get Jessica, appreciative of the ever unfolding and wonderful sort of Star Trek world from that point of view. I did think actually the music, I will give another credit to Rod Jones. I thought there was an eeriness here, a minimalist approach combined with the very triumph, you know, the very kind of martial music, which kind of really emphasized a lot of the scenarios, certainly when the away team first go down to the first planet and they're looking for the Borg footprint, and the fact that, you know, clearly this is a very, very major foe that they're being faced with. I thought that was well handled. However, we are at the time where, for at least Best of Both Worlds Part 1, we need to actually provide a score. We've heard, obviously, what Larry Nemeczek made of it. Quite astounding score for Larry, as we know. Likewise, the same with respect to Ian Barnsley. Jared, what are you going to go for?
I would say I'd give it a 9.5. I think, for me, this is one of the best Next Gen episodes I've watched, and it's definitely the one that's impacted the Star Trek media as well as the Star Trek episodes after that, calls in Deep Space Nine, and especially with Voyager as well, because especially when the Borg come into the later scenes, I do see a lot of Next Gen's sort of ideas, and of course the history where Janeway tries to talk to the Borg when they're versing, I think it's species 4311, I believe it was, in that
4235, I think, or 4235.
Yeah, anyway. Sorry, numbers have always evaded me on that one. But yeah, so it's sort of like a way that this is the moment where sort of like Starfleet gets more of the historical account, and like, of course, the first hand contact with the Borg as well. And as of course, it's set up like the novels and the comics and stuff like that, because according to my dad, apparently Kirk got resurrected to fight the Borg in the comic.
Absolutely.
So I don't know what happened there.
We also very, very recently actually had a 4-issue IDW series called Halloween, in which there's a crossover between Next Generation and original series, but the Borg are indeed working within the holodeck with Red Jack in the whole system. But that's for another time. Jessica, by the way, don't worry about Star Trek Voyager. We haven't as yet looked at that. That will be somewhere down the temporal timelines. But what, Jessica, is your score? If you can, split it in half, because obviously you got another score to give next week for Best of Both Worlds, Part 1.
So I do think that I know Larry was very generous. He gave it that illustrious 10. Which
I'm going a 9, actually. I have to say, if I was pushed for it, it's a 9 for me. But Jessica, you're normally very positive. So where are you going?
I think so. I think I do think I prefer Part 2, but I will give the first part a 9 as well. I can't give it a 10 because the 10 is the tribbles, of course. You can't beat that to me, of course. But you know, it's still a 9.
Very true. Well, that's brought us to the end, at least, of Best of Both Worlds Part 1 on Resonance Rewind. Thanks certainly to Larry Nemeczek, Dr. Trek, of course, and, of course, to Ian Barnsley and to Jared Palmer and Jessica Burtis. And you, dear listener, as ever, we leave you as well with some more music from the episode. And, of course, those three words, not resistance is futile, but keep on resonating.